Welcome to American Patchwork and Quilting Radio, your one stop for creative inspiration. We have a terrific hour of ideas and tips for you today, so let's get to it. Here's your host, Pat Sloan.
Eric is a producer, so he's going to tape everything.
Yeah, I'm recording now, so you can start whenever you're ready, and I'll notate it.
Okay, so Sarah, this is the intro into the whole show, so I'll do that first, and then we'll just start.
Okay.
Welcome to American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan. I thought it'd be really fun for the first segment here to talk a little bit about bags. And of course, to do that, I called on my expert bag maker, Sarah Lawson of So Sweetness. Sarah has been on the show before, and you love everything she has to say. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Pat.
I'm really excited because you and I were writing the other day and you told me that you have some new things going on, which include bags with hardware. You know, is that like a scary term for people?
I mean, most hardware is extremely simple to put into either straps or somewhere on the bag, but I think for some reason it's intimidating, kind of like how people are sometimes intimidated by putting a zipper in.
Right.
Yeah. I have some new hardware shipping to shops and distributors this week, and it's just basic things that I use very commonly in bags. So magnetic snaps, D-rings, invisible snaps, all sorts of basic items.
You know what? I thought we could talk about a couple of them and how you use them and how they install, because I think that always helps people. And you've also done some videos?
Yeah, I have some videos that will be going up on my site hopefully this week. And each bit of hardware that I have that I'll be selling, I shot a quick video on how to install it. So step by step, I'll take you through what they look like, how to sew them, you know, with your sewing machine and all that stuff.
Oh, neat. So I want to talk about the invisible things, because those are ones that I personally have a hard time kind of visualizing. I mean, I know when I buy a bag or I see one of your bags, you know, it's got this great little magnetic clip or something, but I'm like, how in the world do you install those?
Yeah, actually they're really easy. What it looks like, if you're not familiar with it, is there's a round magnet, and it's encased in a 1-inch clear vinyl sleeve. And the sleeve makes it so that you could sew the magnet into your fabric or interfacing. I usually suggest sewing it into interfacing because I like to use Biani Soft and Stable, who I know you've had on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll sew the vinyl sleeve of the magnetic snap directly to the interfacing. Depending on where it needs to be in the bag or flap, I'll either use a tight zigzag stitch all the way around the perimeter of the sleeve, or I'll use two rows of straight stitches, and that just gives it extra stability to hold it in place so it doesn't fall off your interfacing over time.
That's a good point, because you're actually, you know, pulling on that, so it can't just lay right on the fabric.
Right, exactly.
All right, so those are okay. So they don't sound too bad. What are one of the other favorite pieces of hardware that you like to use?
Lately, I've liked putting purse feet into the bottom of a bag, and you can do that with any bag pattern, even if the pattern doesn't call for the purse feet. And what the purse feet look like, it's kind of like a round metal disc, and it has two prongs coming out from the back. And so to insert that in the bottom of your bag, I like to use my seam ripper to make a small slit. I usually make the slits about a 1/2 inch or 2 inches in from each of the four corners of the bag. Mm-hmm. And after I've made the slit with my seam ripper, I like to follow that up with a bit of seam sealant. And again, that just reinforces the fabric since you just made a hole in it. And then
stop 1 second. What's seam seal? I never heard of that.
Seam sealant or fray tech.
Okay.
You can get it at a big box store or at your local quilt shop, and it'll just, it's a liquid that just stops fabric from fraying.
Okay, Frejcek, I know that word, so I hadn't heard it referenced the other way. So, okay. So once you put a little bit of that, and then you're going to insert these feet from the outside?
Right, from the right side of the fabric, and then from the wrong side, you'll just open those prongs outward, and then you're finished. It's really easy.
And how durable are they? Because I actually have a purse that one of them fell out, and it's a purse somebody made for me, and it's a really special bag. And so I thought, I bet I can get a foot and replace it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can. I would just maybe open up the lining a small mm-hmm. bit, and then you can insert the purse foot through the right side and just open the prong again.
Yeah, because it's really the matter of the prongs. I can't really open those from the outside of the purse for a repair job.
Right.
Because it would be
true.
Yeah, unless the lining's kind of loose or something. Oh, okay. So I can get purse feet from you. This is a good thing to know. This, yay! I like purse feet because my bags are heavy and they're big, and I don't want to sit them on the table, so they often need to go, you know, where like the floor and it's dirty and
right.
So
exactly.
Yeah, that's a good thing. So your bags, you have a lot of them where I think they look super professional because you use the hardware and a lot of those rings for like the straps. So the straps mm-hmm. can be adjusted and things like that. How do you handle getting those rings under the sewing machine? Because I always feel like, oh, you know, I don't want to make them too loose so that the fabric sort of bunches up. You know what I mean? How do you get it nice?
Oh, yeah. Actually, depending on the hardware, but in most cases, I like to use my purse foot just for attaching the strapping to the hardware, because then I can get really, really close to the metal of the hardware. And it kind of, the closer you get, the nicer it looks, and it really holds the hardware in place so it's not like jiggling around mm-hmm. as you're carrying your bag.
So what does a purse foot look like? I don't know that I have one.
I misspoke. I'm sorry. Zipper foot. I'm thinking of purses. I meant to say zipper foot.
Okay, zipper foot. All right. So zipper foots are very narrow, and that way you can get in really close. Okay.
Right.
Perfect. What is your most recent bag that you're working on pattern?
I'm finishing it up this morning, right before you called. It's called the Ansel camera bag, and it's a camera bag in three different sizes. It has an adjustable strap, and there's padding on the inside. So I used half-inch foam on the inside and the bottom of the bag just so it's super safe for a camera. And the bag has a lot of structure, so I think I'm pretty happy with how it came out. It's going out to my pattern testers today.
Oh, wow. Camera bags. That is wonderful. You know, they're hard to find nice looking ones.
Yeah, I agree. Either they look nice and they're not safe for the camera, or they're safe for the camera and they're just not as nice looking as you would want, I think.
Unattractive black vinyl. That's
right.
The most popular look.
Yeah.
Or very expensive black leather. You know, that's
right.
Like, and it looks like a man's bag. So, you know, we girls, we use cameras a lot. You share some of these things out on your Instagram kind of as you're going along, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I feel like it helps people get excited about new projects or new patterns that I have coming out. And then when the pattern actually comes out, they usually remember that they've seen it before a few weeks earlier, and hopefully that inspires them to get the pattern and want to make the bag.
Yeah, I like following everybody's Instagrams because an Instagram is a website, for those of you who don't know yet, instagram.com. It's a photo sharing site. And so you can follow designers, you know, and we just share pics of, you know, kind of goings on. Do you have like a lot of people who write to you on there as well?
Yeah, I do get a lot of comments, and I was working on a bag this past December, and I wasn't sure how I was going to go with the, I had flaps I was working on. I didn't know if I wanted them to be pleated or regular, and so I asked on my Instagram, and I actually went with the comments that I received were overwhelming for the pleated flap, and me personally, I would have gone for just the regular plain one, and so I went with what my, I guess, Instagram fans were deciding. And yeah, so it was helpful in that aspect too.
Yeah, it's like a little polling service. You can go out there and just see. And you actually have on your website, and a lot of us do this, you put a feed so that people, if they don't have it, they can just go to your website, sosweetness.com, and see that like on the sidebar or at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I absolutely do.
Yay. So let's switch gears a little bit, Sarah, here. We have about 2 minutes. And you have a new venture that you're working on with some partners called SoPro, a new convention, which I think is super exciting because you asked me to come and give a talk. So tell me a little bit about it.
Okay. So SoPro, we're holding it next fall. So it will be September of 2016. And it's located in Chicago. We sort of wanted a central area to the rest of the country. And I live in Chicago, so it was easy enough for me to go around visiting hotels and sites for the convention. And basically, in a nutshell, the purpose of SoPro is to help the home sewist learn how to do something in the sewing industry based on their passion. So if they want to write a book, if they want to start a blog, a profitable blog, be a fabric designer, design quilt patterns, whatever. The purpose of the lectures in SoPro are to help them get started or get their feet wet. So we'll be teaching them how to do things like licensing fabric, how to digitize designs on the computer, how to lay out quilt patterns to send them to a printer. All that stuff we'll be covering because I feel like it's hard, unless you know somebody, it's hard to get started or know what to do or who to contact. And so we just want to help people who would like to be creative get somewhere in the industry.
That, you know, I think it's a really fantastic idea. There are lots of business conferences in the world for all kinds of things. And the quilt world doesn't, you know, there are the trade shows, but that's different because there's a whole different vibe going on at a trade show. So this, where it's just classes, I think it's going to be exciting. I can't wait to see the kinds of people who come, the other people who will be lecturing. Are there sewing classes too?
We won't actually be sewing. Everything is instructional, and so it won't be as much hands-on. We just want to put the information into the attendees' hands, and hopefully they can go forward from that.
Right. It's a business conference, but it's very cool. And a lot of people who listen to this show are teachers or in the business somewhere. So it's something to look for. And you have a website, right?
Yeah, the website has right now just the basic information. It's www.soproconvention.com. We do have our teachers chosen already, but we'll be getting the teachers on there soon. But the basic information on what types of tracks and classes is on the website.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Sarah, this has been so wonderful. Thank you for coming on and sharing with me today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Pat.
This is American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan. We'll be right back after the break.
Boost your sewing skills from start to finish with daily tips from the editors of American Patchwork and Quilting. Visit tips.allpeoplequilt.com for inspiration.
Hi, I'm Linda Augsburg, executive editor of American Patchwork and Quilting, and I'd like to invite you to join me in making pillowcases and creating smiles. For people who love to sew or quilt, it's so easy to lift spirits and bring smiles to hospitalized kids, homeless families, and others in need. Simply join American Patchwork and Quilting Magazine's 1 Million Pillowcase Challenge. Make one, two, or more pillowcases and donate them in your local community. You'll create just as many smiles. Join the movement today. Find complete details, download free patterns, and record your donations online at allpeoplequilt.com/million pillowcases.
See our editors share their tips, ideas, and techniques by visiting allpeoplequilt.com and clicking on videos. Follow American Patchwork and Quilting on Pinterest to find ideas for bags, baby projects, pillowcases,
storage and organization, and more. Visit Pinterest.com/APQ magazine to join the fun.
It's an outs, and that, you know, because I've been on both ends and you've been on both ends.
Yep.
It'd be fun to, you know, just go through it. So that's, I think, the take. And it's something
Sounds good.
You know, so many people who take on the job as program chair, I mean, they've never done anything like that. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And even if they have good notes
from
before, it's still hard.
Yeah. Okay. So I see a note from Eric that he's ready. So, okay. Welcome back to American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan, and thought it'd be a really good idea to talk about what it's like to bring a speaker into your guild. So many quilters have guilds, they belong to guilds, they belong to many guilds, and they have speakers come in. They might actually take on the job of program chair, or supporting the program chair. And so I contacted my good buddy, Roseanne Kermis of Rosebud's Cottage. And Roseanne belongs to guilds. She has been a speaker, just like I've been a speaker and a teacher and a lecturer. So we're going to go kind of through some points that might be interesting to you for hiring speakers. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. How many guilds do you belong to?
Well, I belong to two, and I joined them specifically because they have good speakers. And that's one of the things I like to go to. I also, you know, like to go and look at the quilts that people show to be inspired that way. But the speakers are what really draw me. And I usually try to clear my schedule so that I can be there for them. In fact, last night I messed up and I didn't go to the guild meeting and missed out on a great speaker, and I'm really sad. So the guild, so they do a good job finding people to come to their groups to speak, but it's not an easy job.
No.
I've had.
Have you been program chair? Have you been a program chair?
Yes.
It me too.
It takes a lot of coordination, a lot of thought, and you know, you have to look back to what you had before that worked or didn't work. And maybe bring back speakers that you had in the past that were popular. So
it's a super exciting job to be the program chair. I teach all over, and like I'm leaving tomorrow to go teach in Florida. And what I find is that a lot of program chairs will say to me they actually took the job so that they could get the teachers they wanted.
That's what I did when I was a program chair. I was program chair for 2 years at a guild, and I did the same thing. I brought in people I thought were interesting.
Mm-hmm. So what are a couple of points? Let's just sort of break it out. I think you and I kind of got it into kind of three segments. Why don't you kick it off?
Okay. Well, I think the first one is to make sure you have a nice mix of topics for your meetings and things. You can have one or two expensive speakers depending on your budget. Local celebrities are great for helping to promote their business and just to kind of get a feel for how they do business in your community. And you don't have to spend a lot of your dues money for that. Our guild does demo days. They call them, like one of them calls it a schoolhouse night, where members come in and show how to do certain things. And people love that because everybody likes to learn. Mm-hmm. You said that you did a survey, or you thought a survey was a good idea too.
Right. People can put out, if you're a program chair or even just your guild, can ask via a poll so that nobody, you be anonymous, you know, who do they like to have speak? What kind of things are they interested in? Are you in a guild that's really into art quilts right now? Well, then, you know, then maybe you don't want to hire a primitive, you know, designer. You know, just get in sync with what the guild is interested in. If they want to learn to applique, well, maybe you might not want to as a program chair, but your guild does. So doing that survey gives you that feedback you need.
Yes. I think the other thing, too, is I think people come into a guild position like that and they think, well, I just have to do it for a year. But in reality, a guild calendar needs to extend beyond a year just because speakers, especially favorite ones, are they're booked out for a while. So in the guild that I had, when I had been a program chair, we had a calendar that actually went out 18 months. So even though our term was for a year, the person coming in still had some room to know what was coming up so she could plan for farther ahead. And that seemed to work pretty well with that guild. But I know I get a lot of last-minute calls that, you know, oh, we forgot to schedule somebody. Could you come and speak to us? And, you know, that's, you know, that happens too. But planning is everything. I know that your calendar is filled out quite a ways out too.
Right. Yeah, looking at an instructor or a lecturer's calendar, sometimes they have them online, but that doesn't mean everything is there, and it doesn't mean all the openings are shown, but then maybe the highlights are there. It just depends on the person. But you want to book out. I remember when I was program chair, we have 12 chapters in my area all under an umbrella guild. So one of the other chapters who met the night before mine contacted me. They were booking somebody a year out, and they said, would you like her the next night? And I'm like, yes, because that saved everybody. It saves the speaker time, and it saves us time, and it makes it worthwhile for all of us to partner like that. So my guild's unusual that we have chapters within this huge organization, but you might have a guild in the next town that you know that you could say, well, we're bringing in Roseanne, and, you know, can you take her the next night when your meeting is? So all that sort of partnering helps you build that calendar up without having to do necessarily all the legwork, right?
Yes. And, you know, I know some guilds, too, that they will actually combine their resources so they can get a more expensive speaker and will do it on a special night. And one of the things that it works to their advantage is then people get to see the other guilds in the area, and there's always that cross membership too. So that's a big thing. I like doing things like that. I am a big fan of looking to your community. There are so many hidden people who have something to offer. There's a woman here in the Twin Cities that has written a great book, and she came to a guild that I belong to with the story of how, you know, quilting in her family that went back into the 1800s. And that was just very interesting, but I had never realized who she was or that she even had a book. And so it's that kind of thing. I think sometimes people have to sleuth out what they have nearby.
Right. The other thing that I've been to guild meetings, more like, you know, my local ones, but they've gone and gotten somebody who does documentation and talks about how you can document your quilts. Back at, you know, one point when sort of scrapbooking was new, they had somebody come in and do that. Another time was ergonomics. You get like a health professional of some sort, maybe from a local gym, a yoga instructor, somebody who can talk about the ergonomics of what we're doing when we sew so that we can stay healthy.
Yeah, or we had someone about a year ago at one of the guilds where she talked about how judges judge. And that was an eye-opener for, you know, I thought I knew some of that, but it was interesting to see what the judges are looking at and how nitpicky they can be when they're having to make a choice between two people. So those are all interesting topics. But yeah, you should look around, you know, look nearby. There's so many people who have that, who want that opportunity to talk to a group.
I want to touch base just because I know we'll run out of time here at any second, but can we, I'm going to talk about the contracts and stuff because people need to, you know, when you're hiring somebody coming from out of town or even somebody local, there'll be fees and you want to contract them. They may have a contract. Your guild might have a contract. Tell me a little bit about how to approach somebody like locally, because you know, that's happened with you.
Well, locally, most people, you know, we have a lot of designers in our area in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota, and our guild pays for, we pay their typical speaking fee, and then we usually pay transportation back and forth, you know, like gas mileage, for their transportation to the wherever the meeting is. I know a guild a while ago who ran into trouble because they had contracted with a speaker and they weren't able to afford it, perhaps, and they're charging fees for it. And they ran into trouble because they hadn't read the cancellation fee clearly and hadn't budgeted for it. And they ended up having to pay airfare and hotel arrangements and things that they didn't think they would have to So those are important things, I think, to make sure that you have that money for a bigger speaker set aside in your budget and put away so nobody can touch it, and it's earmarked just for that. You never know what'll happen.
Well, even if you're booking in the winter, I mean, a lot of speakers don't even want to fly in January because the probability of not making your event, if you have to fly or drive, since I drive a lot, is difficult. I mean, right now we were watching weather to leave to Florida because we were supposed to get 10 inches of snow last night, and we didn't. But, you know, you have to look at those things.
Yes. I think, too, you know, a lot of times I think guilds think that a shop owner should just come out gratis to talk to their group, either because they feel the guild will come back and buy at their store or something in that order. I think they need to look at ask a store owner, what do you charge to come out and talk? Because most of the time a shop is going to be teaching them something, and to treat them fairly like that, because, you know, they've probably left their family at home or have had to miss something because they're coming to your guild. So I think you need to treat a shop owner like you would a designer, you know, pay their fee and get them mileage back and forth too. So I think that's important as well.
Right. I think that, just like you said, the very polite thing to do is you ask, what is your teaching fee? And then if the person, you know, has whatever their fee is, at least then it's not awkward. It's like, it's a business transaction. Same if you were going to contact that author who wrote that book. I mean, you ask them, what is your speaking fee? And then you decide if it's in your budget. So it's always, you always assume you're going to have to pay for people to speak at your chapter, unless they happen to be, you know, I don't know, your own members doing demo day or something, you know?
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing, too. If you have to, like, balance your budget that way, you can have your members be part of your guild program. Like I said, I've been to some great ones where the members are the ones that were showing how to use a tool or reviewing a book or, you know, things like that, that have been just eye-opening, you know, little tricks that you never would know. There's a lot of talent inside the guild, and a lot of people like to show off what they know. So that's really fun. You know, another thing, we often have like swaps or garage sale types of things where people can spend $5 for a table, and then they can bring items to sell. And of course, most of them just get swapped back and forth. but you know, sometimes you want to clean out what you have, but you want to make sure that it gets in the right hands. And it's also a fundraising, you know, part for the guild as well. And so they're fun. And there's other nights where we've gone and we've just had a social night where people bring things to hand stitch and then maybe some little
games.
That's
always fun.
Yeah.
Roseanne, this has been great. Loads of good ideas. Thanks for coming on and bouncing guild programs around with me.
Great. Sounds good. Thanks, Pat.
This is American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Choose from more than 100 of your favorite patterns from American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilts and More, and Quilt Sampler, all available online. Buy downloadable patterns today at apqshop.com.
The 1 million pillowcase challenge is hitting the road. Come sew with the staff of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine at the Sewing and Stitchery Expo in Puyallup, Washington, February 26th through March 1st of 2015. Everything needed to make the pillowcases will be available for free. Pillowcases will be donated to the children being treated at Mary Bridge Children's Hospital. Stop by the Showplex and use your sewing skills to help a good cause. If you can't stay to make a pillowcase, no worries. Drop off your completed pillowcase to add to the total. See you there.
Here's a special offer just for radio listeners. Get 2 full years of American Patchwork and Quilting delivered right to your door for less than half the cost on the newsstand. You won't miss an issue that's packed with never-before-seen projects from top designers, complete materials lists for all projects, and easy-to-use pull-out patterns and quilting diagrams. Subscribe today online, and you'll also get a free downloadable pattern. Check it out. Go to allpeoplequilt.com.
See what other quilters are up to on the American Patchwork and Quilting page on Facebook. Simply go to facebook.com and search for APQ Magazine.
Welcome back to American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan, and I have got the fabulous Valerie Wells. She is a fabric designer, an author, a photographer extraordinaire, and a fabulous businesswoman who does many, many things. And today we're going to talk about her book and get some backstory about how her style has changed over the years. So Valerie, I'm really excited about this because your work has spoken to me on so many levels for so many years. It's just wonderful to have you here.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you. That means a lot.
I think I own everything that you've done. You know, it's like, oh, Valerie stuff. I just love it. Did you actually grow up in the quilt shop? Your mother is Jean Wells, and she owns the Stitching Post. She started the Stitching Post. Was that part of your life from birth?
Mom opened it. It was 1975, so I was almost 2 years old when she opened the shop. So this year is our 40th anniversary.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, I don't know any different.
It's just incredible to think about, you know, how long she has been in the business, but that you actually, you know, people say, oh, I grew up in a quilt shop. Well, you really did grow up there.
I did.
Do you have memories of like playing in the store?
Oh, lots of memories of playing in the store. Well, and you know, I remember walking from kindergarten down to the shop and helping mom in the shop, and I would help customers and I learned to count change back and things like that. So
did you think you would be in the quilt industry when you were like a teenager?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't think I didn't think I would, but I didn't think that it wasn't like topic of conversation at all. And mom never pushed that on me. Mm-hmm. I decided to do it later. So, no, I was into photography. So I studied photography in art school, and it wasn't until my senior year that I started doing some stuff for mom that mm-hmm. then got me back into fabric and such.
So when, you know, so you had quilts as you were growing up. I assume you got to have some of the quilts your mom made.
Oh, some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, she would put me in little sewing camps in the summer, and so I knew mm-hmm. how to sew. I just had absolutely no interest in it until mm-hmm. late in college years.
When you were doing your photography, and you still do photography, it's like just such a part
yeah.
of your whole process. What does that add to what you do now?
I use it as my inspiration for everything. Mm-hmm. I draw from photos a lot better. I will just lay out a ton of photos and find bits and pieces of inspiration to put fabric together. You find color palettes in photos. I'm just, you know, I think since I started doing photography so young, it's just a part of who I am and slightly obsessive about it. So, it just kind of fits into every bit of my life. My children are very used to me having a camera nowadays, you know, I have my phone all the time. So,
right.
You know, it's a good thing. It just, you know, I think when you start something super young and it's a creative thing and you're a really creative person, it tends to stick to you and become part of whatever avenue of creativity you go forth in.
And what's interesting is like out on your site, which is valeriewells.com, you have a lot of inspiration things. You have a whole section called Inspiration Well, which is a lot of your photos with and without quilts.
Yeah. 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 Just everything. Because I photograph everything. We went for a hike the other morning, my husband and the dog and I, because, well, we needed to and the dog needed it.
Yeah.
And it was gloomy and cold and foggy and all the colors were standing out like crazy around here. So I, you know, stopped the whole way and took pictures. Because you never know. I mean, you may like that gray at some point for fabric. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you just never know.
So how has your quilting changed from when you first started? You did one style and your mom has done the same thing. Because of being in it so many years, you evolve.
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember like pinpoints of when you started changing?
Well, I think, okay, so I first started doing, Mom taught me Crazy Patch and Stitch and Flip, and I got, yeah, I obviously have a very obsessive sort of personality. I get into something and I dive into it. And so I did a whole book on it, the whole Stitch and Flip book.
Yeah.
And then she taught me how to do Radiant, or how to do New York Beauties. And that's like a whole nother thing. That, and of course, this was all before children.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we did, yeah, I played around with all sorts of different things, but I haven't had taken any classes except for stuff that Mom's taught me. So mm-hmm. I just kind of go by the seat of my pants. Nowadays, you know, I love traditional blocks, but then I also really, my mom started doing a lot of, and I guess you call it free form or mm-hmm. piecing and cutting, you know, curves and straightish lines. And all of that has really influenced the way I sew, even though I do it completely different than my mom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting because we have evolved, but we're also kind of similar. We are inspired by each other a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. I think that's really cool. I don't, my mom, my family, there's nobody that sews. So I don't have like any kind of genetics to like play into it. You know, it's like seeing any family member doing it. I think that that's really neat. Let's talk a little bit. You do a lot of, when we talk about your book, we'll talk about some other things, but what is your studio space like? I mean, you do printing and you do all kinds of stuff. Do you
yeah.
have a massive studio space?
I have, my studio space is above our 2-car garage, and it has big vaulted ceilings. So it's big space. And mm-hmm. Because I don't do one thing at a time very well. So I have multiple things going on. So I have an area where I do all my drawings for my fabric, and then I have like computer and sewing, and then I have a room that was originally my dark room,
mm-hmm.
and which now stores fabric, and I do all my screen printing and store all my inks and stuff from in there because I have a big sink in there. So.
Oh, okay.
So there's always more than one thing going on. Like, I mean, I just got some photo emulsion in, and so I'm making 3 screens today, and I'm working on a new fabric collection, and there's a quilt on the wall, and so there's lots. There's always lots going on up here. My husband always says, "Oh, it's like your brain."
Yeah, it is, isn't it? That's so true.
Yeah,
it's like
it is.
You could just walk in there and see everything that's bouncing around in your head, right? It's
yes, and sometimes more organized than others.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure.
Now you are also a painter. So I think way back in the beginning, correct me if I'm wrong, you painted your fabric lines and then they became fabric lines. Like you had, you know, big paintings. What do you do now?
Well, now I don't paint it anymore because I found that, you know, the computer really can be your paintbrush for you,
mm-hmm.
at least the way that I design a lot of times. It's my color tool and allows me to change things really quickly and easily and saves mm-hmm. me a lot of time. So, but I draw everything first, and if it's going to be a big repeat, I'll draw out the whole repeat, and then I ink. My scanner only scans, you know, 8.5 by 11, so mm-hmm. I'll then take this large 24 by 22-inch repeat and ink up sections. So I like to just use either India ink or my Copic pens and stuff like that. And so I'll ink them all up and scan them in and then put them back together in the computer in the repeat based on my original repeat. So it's a process,
mm-hmm.
but it allows me, you know, it allows me to still have a hand-drawn look and have that control. And I think better using paper than I do using the, as far as like repeats, I think mm-hmm. better using the paper and being able to repeat that way than to do it in Illustrator. So unless it's a really simple, you know, repeat, you know, squares or something
right.
like that. But
right.
the computer allows you to change color palettes and really tweak things so you get them just right.
That's,
and I
it
like
is,
to paint it over
yeah,
and over again.
Yeah, that's so true. You work a lot faster that way.
Yeah, because I used to paint it, and then if I didn't get, you know, I recently did a massive purge in my studio and had found old bits of illustration board that I used to test my color to make sure it was the same color as I had used before. So I had all my colors exactly right. It was ridiculous why I saved them, but I had all these pieces of board like that. So the computer is very helpful in that way.
Yeah, and just space-wise, you know, therefore you can, you know, store all these variations and you don't have to have that taken up in your floor space or your shelf space.
Exactly.
Or something.
Exactly. And
like
you can
that.
Use it for other things. I can use it for advertising. I can use it, and you know, I can use bits and pieces. I a lot of times take my bits and pieces that I pull in and I make them into screens, and then I screen print with them because a lot of times I just like the design, and so I'll make it into a big elephant or something because I'm not going to be able to make fabric that big, so I might as well make my own.
When, you know, your work has a level of detail in it, do you sort of, is that how you think, or do you like sketch it sort of open and then enter the detail after? I'm just kind of curious.
On my fabric designs?
Yeah.
You know, I do all of it early on. Like I'm a detail. I like the little details of things. Mm-hmm. Probably why I like photography so much, because you get fine details. And definitely, my mom reminds me that sometimes I don't have to be so complex. and it's true. Sometimes I get carried away with the little details, and sometimes you need something simple and just clean and simple to work with your over-detailed stuff.
Yeah.
So, I try and find a balance. I try and make sure that every collection, I push myself a little bit more to be a little bit better than I was, you know, or I try something new.
That's, I love it. You know, we're going to take a little break, Valerie. And when we come back, then we're going to talk about your book called My Life in Fabric, which is like so perfect, that title. I love it. So we'll be right back in a few minutes with American Patchwork and Quilting Podcast.
Looking for fresh, simple, and fun projects and ideas? Check out the current issue of Quilts & More magazine at your local quilt shop or on newsstands.
This quilting tip brought to you by Moda Fabrics. Visit modafabrics.com or your local quilt shop to see the latest fabric collections. Once fabric pieces have been pressed, let them cool in place before moving them. It prevents distortion of bias edges.
Hi, I'm Linda Augsburg. Join me in 2015 for a brand new video series called Show Me How, brought to you by Baby Lock. Each month, I'll show you how to complete a simple project from start to finish, learn new techniques, see tips, and sew a great project. Visit allpeoplequilt.com/videos to watch.
Take an ultimate shop hop tour of 11 top quilt shops. You'll find them all in the current issue of Quilt Sampler, available now at your local quilt shop or on newsstands.
Welcome back to American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan, and I'm talking to Valerie Wells. And we are going to chat about your book, My Life in Fabric. So did you come up with that title, Valerie?
It was a group effort with CNT. I think I originally had always called it Life in Fabric because I live in fabric.
Yes.
And, you know, how many of us like tablecloths and napkins and I make this and I make that, and, you know, it's your life in fabric.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, tell me the concept of the book, because it really covers a lot of interesting things besides your background and, you know, but just a couple different techniques.
I really wanted to, I hadn't done a book in a really long time, and I wanted to kind of incorporate how I use fabric in my life. So, you know, like I said, I do a lot of silk screening and I do block printing. And so I incorporated how to create those to then, you know, make quilts out of. I like to do funky piecing and make big quilts. But then at the same time, I make dresses for my little girls and, you know, make use old sweaters because I have a really hard time throwing them away, and I made them into stuffed owls. So I gave them to my friends for Christmas one year and decided they would be a great pattern.
The owls are adorable. They are so fun. Well, tell me, one of the things that I was fascinated about was you did put a section on photography, and you mm-hmm. talk about different apps and also about how to use like something like Rona Designs sort of app to add to your photos. That's really fun.
Well, I love doing that stuff. And, you know, because I don't have a darkroom anymore, which so much you can do so much quicker now rather than a darkroom. But I love the apps that are like old cameras or that I can go in and manipulate and, you know, where I can put text on it and things like that. And it's a fun way to, you know, one, play with photography, but then also just play with design concepts and color and, yeah, so I use them a lot.
Really,
I use a lot of those.
It's creative,
a lot.
Right? I mean,
yeah. Well, you can be creative. You know, I have to find creativity in lots of different areas. In everything that we do. Even though, you know, the store, like going to the store, you wouldn't think is creative. It's still is quite creative when you're thinking about buying fabric and, you know, all of that stuff. And managing people tends to be a very creative adventure. So everything you do relates to that. So, you know, you might as well make your photos fun too and find ways of incorporating them into things that you do with fabric.
I agree. I totally agree. Everything is to be, it's like, make it fun, you know, do something that stretches the brain. When did you take all the photos for the book? Pretty much.
I took a ton of the photos. The photos that were done, the set shots with the quilt, they're kind of like in their big pages, were done by a friend of mine's son, who's in his early 20s, and he went to school for photography, and I thought he's the perfect person to come because he has no preconceived ideas, and I really wanted to have him feel a certain way and be styled a certain way, and I already knew that he had the talent, so he did those for me. They were just phenomenal. And then all the other photos are just stuff that, you know, are my inspiration or things that I use, whether it be color or, you know, just random things that inspire me.
I just am in love with the Baker's Twine quilt. That is just, it is so neat.
Well, thank you. That one, and, you know, honestly, that one was, I started making way before I even did the book. And, you know, it's not very often I find myself like really wanting to make a quilt just to make a quilt, not because I have to, since so much of my time is spent on, I have to promote this fabric. I need to do this quilt for, you know, this person or that person. So to actually like just go, oh, I just want to make this. So, you know, granted, it ended up being a pattern, but, you know, it's kind of cool when you actually get an opportunity to do something like that. And it takes a lot longer to get them done, but it's important to make sure you, you know, you add that in.
It is. And this one is all about the Baker's Twine, which is that two color twine, if you're not familiar with it. And then you had this great shot of it on the bed and your dog and, you know, from up above. I like that.
Yeah, it was my parents' dog.
Oh, it was your parents' dog. Okay. I know I have a dog in one of my books. It's my friend's dog. It's not my dog. So tell me about the screen printing, because I am fascinated by that. Personally, it's not something I've really ever done, but you showed multiple ways to incorporate just bits of that in your book. Can you talk about it a little bit?
About how to make screens and stuff like that? And I mean, it really is these days just quite simple. And I mean, I just use this little floodlight and, you know, a dark room, and that's all you really, you know, if you have a bathroom that can be darkened, you can do a screen print and a surface, which you do, you have the floor and you can hang a little light. You know, what I do is I take, like I said, a lot of my images, that I have inked up. So they're already black and white. And then I print them on a transparency and the next thing you know, you can easily make a screen out of it. But then there's other ways you can do screens. You can do screens by just painting on a screen. But everything is so easy nowadays, you know, mm-hmm. and it's all water soluble, easy cleanup, and everything, things are really readily available. And it's a super fun process. And, you know, it takes a little bit longer to get it all the way to the screen print. But then once you start printing, you're like, oh, I need more fabric. I need more fabric. Yeah. Oh, I could print on this. I should try that.
And you've put them in the quilts as accent pieces, as strips. So you don't have to. And you know, they're really
printing,
neat.
Same thing with block printing. Yeah. Block printing, I'm already pre-printed fabric. I mean, I like trying. I mean, I love solids. Printing on solids is, you know, definitely my favorite. But sometimes I like to see if I can't print on top of one of my own designs and see if it'll actually work. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, but it's worth the experiment.
Mm-hmm. It's only a little time. Doesn't take much time. give it a go.
Well, once you have the screen done, you can just print on anything, you know, you can print on paper and yeah. So, you know, it's just a really fun process. And I also like getting ink all over me and things like that, you know?
You're Hands so on. you have do so many things. It is just amazing.
Thank you.
How do you sort of keep track of that? Are you super organized also? An organized creative?
Not depends on what you think organized is. I am to a certain extent, I'm organized. Like I know. You could walk in my studio and go, geez, it's kind of a disaster. I know what every pile is, and mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
But I think that I've done it for so long, and I know what I need to do. I'm really good at making lists, mm-hmm. and you know, I have to just make myself be able to do what I can get done a day, and then shut it off. So when the kids get home, I actually make it, you know. We do dinner and stuff like that, and I'm not caught up here. So it's a balance.
And how much time do you spend between, I mean, I know it's not like a cut and dry thing, but do you set aside time for, you know, working in your studio and then you have store time because you also have the store to run?
Yeah. I usually spend 3 days ish in the studio. Granted, a lot of times in my studio, I'm working on patterns for the shop and things like that. So there is mm-hmm. stuff that, you know what I mean? And then I'm probably mm-hmm. in the shop 2 days a week, just doing meetings and catching up and redo displays and, you know, just kind of being there because trying to get my mom to take a little bit more time in the studio for herself and not be there as much because, you know, mm-hmm. she's 72 this year and she doesn't need to be, yeah. So we're trying to help her transition.
Yeah. What a good daughter you
Which
are.
It's hard. It's 40 years. I mean, you can't expect somebody to do that overnight. But
no.
She deserves to get more studio time, you know. And we have a great team at the store. So, I mean, it allows me to spend 3 days a week here in the store or in the mm-hmm. studio.
Right.
And then, you know, closer to summer when we're really busy, I'm less here because I have less deadlines here. And then I'm at the shop more. Most of my deadlines for, you know, fabric and all that stuff are in the fall and winter and spring months. Summer I try to keep just for the shop.
And now you have how many? You have 3 children, is that right?
I have 3 children, yes.
Yeah.
One is homesick today.
Are they interested in creative things?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Let's see, 9, 7, and 5. My 9-year-old and 7-year-old both like to sew. Teague, who's my 5-year-old, is just obsessed with my sewing machine because he thinks they're cool. I think he might be some sort of engineering type kid. And the girls like to sew stuff, and we do some sewing. You know, they love to draw and paint, and so because I'm usually sketching or doing something like that downstairs, and so my kids will immediately be doing stuff like that. So they're very creative.
that's, you know, that's, it's interesting because some parents have children who end up having, you know, maybe they're into sports instead. And so they don't really, you know, do mm-hmm. that part. Mm-hmm. So it's nice that you can introduce them to a variety. Are any of them taking up photography?
They love to take pictures. Oh, yeah. They love to take pictures. I seriously think my oldest will probably, I mean, granted, who knows? She's nine.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I do. She is very much a creative soul. I think will definitely be an artist. She hasn't, you know, definitely see her going that way. My son might be a sports kid like my husband, but, you know, you never know. And then the middle one, you know, she's unpredictable. The middle child.
Yeah. The variety is there.
Yes, we have a very active, loud, interesting, fun house. So, and it's a good thing, you know, it's the way life should be.
It's an awesome thing. Do they end up going to the quilt store too, so they can grow up and say, you know, I grew up in a quilt store?
Oh yeah. They have a lot more space to run around in than I did originally. I mean, you can have some serious good tag going on in there in the after hours, running through the bolts of fabric and stuff. We have a big, huge cutting table in the shop, and underneath it is all of the batting. Mm. And they like to play hide and seek, and they usually end up underneath there. We make them dust. Like, while you're back there.
Yeah. Yeah, we got to get them trained, you know.
Uh-huh.
Put that away while you're down there. That's
I know. Could you tidy that?
Right. Valerie, this has been so exciting to talk with you and hear about your creative journey and your new book, My Life in Fabric with Valerie Wells. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I always enjoy chatting with you.
And I will catch up with you soon.
All right. Take care.
This is American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan. Please visit us online at allpeoplequilt.com and visit me at patsloan.com. We'll see you next week.
Remember to visit allpeoplequilt.com for more information on topics from today's show, as well as how-to videos, free printable patterns, and additional tips and techniques. Thanks for listening to American Patchwork and Quilting Radio.